The title of my talk is a bit provocative, obviously, against coming papers. Well, I suppose you read the abstract. Here's another version of the abstract, just about what I want to say here. So usually we think of a quantum system as being given by a Hilbert space of states and an operator algebra of observables. So we think that of those things as some of the most of the core ingredients, let's say, of a quantum system. And so basically, as I say here, in this talk, I want to argue against this. Okay. So, well, let's just get started. Okay, so that's an outline. So first, I want to talk about what are the problems of the, let's say, standard point of view or standard framework, and argue for the need to change this. And then I'm basically giving a concrete proposal for how one could possibly formulate parts of the foundations of quantum theory in a way that addresses some of these problems. And then at the end I come back to where are the commutators there, and associated with this new point of view or new framework, which is still incomplete, an outlook towards a new correspondence principle in that framework. Okay, so let us start with a standard quantum theory and reminding ourselves of the most basic ingredients. So that's really just to set up the language if you want. Nothing new or exciting here. So one important aspect that I want to stress here is that quantum theory, in the way it's built up and evolved historically, is really modeled after non-relativistic classical mechanics, right? So there's this table of analogies, if you want. So in classical mechanics, the states of a system are elements in a phase space, which is usually manifold, where in the quantum theory we have a Hilbert space with elements we also call states. Then the dynamics, infinitesimal in a classical mechanical system, is given by some Hamiltonian vector field on this manifold. And in the quantum theory, we have something corresponding, which is the Hamiltonian operator on the Hilbert space. Then if we exponentiate this here or here, then we get a certain symplectic transformation here on this phase space, depending on the initial and final times. And here, time evolution operator, which is a unitary operator on the Hilbert space. Observables in the classical case are basically simply real-valued functions on this phase space. And in the quantum theory, they would form an algebra of operators on the Hilbert space, right? So it's all just nothing exciting. One important thing, of course, about this correspondence is that this is a rather superficial correspondence, because, of course, the operational role of the quantum mechanical structures that appear here is quite different from that of the classical counterparts here. And this is the main reason for why quantum theory is tied much more strongly to this non-relativistic setting that we have here than the classical mechanics here. Okay. So let's look at this a bit in more detail, this last point. So in particular, I want to stress that the operational meaning of these ingredients of quantum theory is tied to a background time, right? So So the Hilbert space of states. So a state really encodes information about the system between measurements, right? Because as we know, a measurement can change a state. And the inner product on the Hilbert space then allows to extract probabilities. The algebra of observables, so of course an observable encodes a possible measurement on the system, and a measurement changes the state to a new state. The product of this algebra encodes, in some sense, the temporal composition of measurements. Right? And then also we have the unitary operators that describe evolution in time, and probabilities then conserved in time. So all these ingredients obviously make reference in a strong way to an external notion of time. That's why I highlighted some words here in red. So these are the words that refer to time, of course. Okay. Well, I mean, the idea is that you, I mean, the usual commutation relation stuff, if you measure position, then momentum, and if you measure first momentum, then position, you don't get the same thing. And that's because, so the commutator, in some sense, is supposed to tell you what happens if you measure this first and the other, or the other first and then this. Right? And so the product there is really the temporal composition of measurements. Right. I know that's just a non-relativistic quantum mechanics, if you want. So that's nothing. Yeah. Well,
I don't want to say about. You completely left
out the integral formulation of quantum mechanics. You've assumed, you know, that whole table and so on is only using the one of the two or three different formulations.
Yeah, so
but
I want to
look very different.
Let's say I wanted to use the one that in some sense corresponds to the smallest denominator of what's usually accepted. But of course,
well,
you might disagree with that, and you might say, well, I really should do it in a different way. Maybe
you should do it in a different way, but I'm saying there is another way, so that would lead to different kind of, well,
yeah,
but I think it's very relevant that other way. I'm raising it because that other way is very relevant to the kind of issues that you highlighted here.
Yeah, perhaps I suppose that in the course of my talk we'll probably come closer to what you had in mind, and maybe then we can come back to if that's partially addresses what I'm going to talk about. Okay. So yeah. So of course, this strong appearance of the concept of a background time has implications when we want to talk about not a non-relativistic setting, but a special relativistic or general relativistic setting. So of course, in special relativity, there's no preferred frame and thus no preferred background time. However, we know very well that this is a problem that can be fixed and has been fixed a long time ago in quantum field theory. But what I want nevertheless to emphasize that this is more a fix than really addressing the issue. Okay. But I guess it will become clearer later. Now, in a general relativistic physics, there's no fixed metric and hence no background time at all. And then we're in even deeper trouble.
I'm not quite sure what you mean in the second point. I mean, you can do this against, I don't know what you mean by there's no fixed metric. So the metric is changes. Place to place. I'm not sure why general relativity, I guess, is in any worse shape than special relativity, if you could maybe pinpoint that a little bit. In other words, there's no preferred frame, you know, locally there's no preferred frame general relativity, but you could pick a local foliation and then the problem might become matching it up unambiguously with neighboring points. But
I mean, the point is, maybe I should have emphasized this more. What I mean, of course, when I talk about this not fixed metric is that the metric itself should be part of the quantum mechanical description. So that's what I have in mind here, right? I mean, when I talk about relativistic or general relativistic physics,
this is a quantum gravity problem, not a
yes,
not a quantum field theory in Hertz space
problem. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying this point. Okay. Then there's another problem, somewhat related to that, of course, which I like to call the quantum cosmology problem. So if we would like to have a fundamental quantum theory, in some sense, then a state in this theory would a priori be a state of the whole universe. Okay, so if we did want to describe, for example, something like quantum gravity. But of course, in quantum theory, the observer must be outside the observed system, at least. There's no agreed framework that really goes beyond this, that everybody would say, okay, yes, this is the way how to do quantum theory with the observer in itself being subject to the measurement, to the quantum measurement. Also, of course, we cannot hope to be able to describe the universe in all its details. So how's this problem solved? I mean, of course, all the time we describe systems as isolated from the rest of the universe. So how do we do that? So in quantum field theory, distant systems with respect to the background metric are independent in the following way. So we have a cluster decomposition principle, which means that the S matrix, which is the usual tool in quantum field theory to describe systems of particles, so that this S matrix factorizes. So here's a bunch of particles, and here's a bunch of particles. And the fact that this S matrix factorizes means that we can describe, for example, just this bunch of particles without really caring what's happening here. So to be more precise, we can successfully describe this bunch of particles as if there was an empty Minkowski universe which just these particles in it, right? But of course, this very strongly depends on the background metric. So as soon as we don't have this background metric anymore, there's no known solution to this problem.
I don't understand what does the cluster separability have to do with the fact that S1 alone then has to be named Minkowski the ground.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a Minkowski background. But that uses the empirical fact that space is almost flat around us. Okay, but
if you said S1 is a strong gravitational field, that is not true anymore, right?
Right. Right.
Okay, so
and then, of course, quantum field theory breaks down. Right.
When you say quantum field theory, evidently you mean flat space quantum field theory.
Yes, I mean quantum field theory in the like textbook applications, particle physics. Yeah. Okay, so from this, I would like to conclude that the standard ingredients, by which I mean here Hilbert space of states plus observable algebra, are unsuitable as a foundation for quantum theory in general. Okay. I mean this in the following sense. So when I say foundation for quantum theory, then I would like this to be a foundation that applies to every quantum theory. Okay. So in particular, it should apply to a possible fundamental theory where these problems that I mentioned before would occur. Okay, so then to be more concrete, because of this background time problem, we need an interpretation or a system that has an interpretation which does not refer explicitly to background time or space-time. And because of this quantum cosmology problem, we need structures that can describe physics locally in a manifest way. So remember, I mean, here to describe physics locally, this locality is not manifest in the formulation of the quantum theory. It's a feature that comes out this cluster decomposition and that uses the background metric. Okay, it's not manifest in the formulation.
Well, I mean, but there's a lot of locality that is manifest. The hyperbolic character of the differential equations.
You're talking about the classical physics now.
Right? No, the quantum. The operator equations, let's say. I mean,
yeah, but this is with respect to a background
metric.
It is all
with respect to a background metric.
Yeah, I mean, this is precisely this same type of locality that I'm talking about. Yeah, I mean, there are different aspects. There's this cluster decomposition that.
Oh, I thought you were saying that wasn't built into the axiom. I missed your point. I thought your point
it depends.
This comes out, but it's not built in. But there are
right.
There are aspects of locality that are built in.
Yeah, I think we will come later back to this point. I think what you have in mind is commutators which have to vanish when there's a space-like separation between the areas where they depend. We'll come back to precisely this later.
And the hyperbolicity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with respect to the constant structure of the space-time. Okay, so now again to quantum field theory, because in some sense, I was arguing, okay, so the standard formalism is really built on a non-relativistic foundation, and it can be fixed in some sense to apply in a special relativistic setting, as we all know, in quantum field theory. But what I want to argue here is that in quantum field theory, we already see that this formalism isn't quite adequate, and that some other things are happening there, and that we can learn something from what's happening there, okay, about what we should do. Okay, so first, standard observers of quantum field theory, and here I usually mean the standard textbook quantum field theory, to be specific, that's used in particle physics mostly. So standard observers of quantum field theory are values of fields and their derivatives at space-time points. So that means that these observers carry a label specifying when and where they are applied, in some sense. Okay. And I mean, the when is the important thing here. Okay. So before, I was just talking about observers as a non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where usually in the Schrodinger picture, think of them as applicable at any time that you want. Okay. But here, they have a label which tells you at which time they are to be applied. So in particular, this implies that there's only one operationally meaningful composition of two such observables, which is given by the commutative time order product, right? I mean, it only makes sense to compose the observable such that the earlier comes first and then the later and so on, right? I mean, this is the only order that let me make this point explicitly. So in quantum field theory, all physically measurable quantities are constructed via the time order product. So if you look into your textbooks and look the LSE procedure to get the S matrix, and you get the endpoint functions coming in there, which themselves can be vacuum expectation values of time order products. Right?
Missions we use the sense of observables because it's a relativistic system, so there's a constraint in that system. So
here they are, if you want, they're the phi of x and d by dt phi of x.
But really, these guys are not observables. To get observable, you really have to take your S matrix. That is, you really have to put the
Well, I mean, they are observables in the same sense that the operators that we talked about before are observables.
Which one? No,
yeah, that you can take an expectation value, for example.
Yeah, but they don't commute, they are not the arc observable. They don't commute with the constraints of
the LVC. Well, I'm not concerned with constraints or. So if you want, well, of course, if you have gauge symmetries, you have to be a bit more careful.
I'm just saying that in theory, you can use the physical BDS methods. Every correlation function before is not truly an observable. So.
Well, I mean, that it depends what concept of observer you're talking about here. So I'm talking about the one which is straightforward, the same as in the non-relativistic setting. Okay.
But then you need a sphere, though, here.
Yes, I mean, of course, yeah. I mean, usually you would have to smear these things. So I'm glossing over those details.
I'm worried about
the
fact that in the relativistic context, so let's say the particles needs to satisfy constraints. An observable needs to be an object that commutes with these constraints. So that's why you really have to, you know, go on shell. So it is the only real physical observables.
Well, yeah, I mean, the issue of on shell and off shell is.
Particle physicists do, they, you know, when they do physics, they just talk only in terms of the aspect.
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, these things give rise to S matrix elements, if you want. I mean, of course, there are some. It's I mean, when you have a quantity in let's say also non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and you say it's an observer, it doesn't mean that this quantity itself. I mean, to relate it to something that you physically measure, you have to take expectation values or transition amplitudes and moduli square or things like that. I mean. That's the same here.
But that's the point you were making in the beginning. In non-relativistic theory, there is a preferred time. Therefore, there's no constraints. And anything you can look at is really truly observable. In relativistic theory, you don't have a definition of time. You have the constraints. And therefore, the notion of observable is more subtle.
Yeah, but there's no problem here with respect, I mean, in that sense. I mean, well, maybe if you wait for a bit more, you will. Maybe there will be things that satisfy your question or your issues. Yeah. But I mean, this is really not. I'm not using any advanced notions. Or, I mean, this is all very basic. So what I want to emphasize. So these quantities are constructed using the time order product, and the non-commutative operator product is actually never used in the end. Okay. I mean, of course, in textbooks, usually you start with this product and quantizing the Lang-Gordon field or something, and then you view this time order product as a derived quantity of that. Right. But it turns out that this, what you thought of as more fundamental, perhaps, actually is never used in the end.
Just another, I mean, of course, the time order product is the one that comes directly out of the parasynthesis.
Yes, yes. And indeed, I mean, well, I guess I'll come to that later, that I would say maybe one word about parasynthesis, but at the very end.
It might be a slight exaggeration to say the non-commutative operator product is never used.
Why?
You read people talk a lot about the Whiteman functions, for example.
Right, but you can use the, how are the other quantities? You can use the, I mean, for the S matrix, for example, you only need the time order 10-point functions. And nothing else.
I think it's a slight exaggeration. Well, you mean if you say they never use, I mean,
yeah, well,
setting up the whole quantum field.
Yeah, what I mean is, in this calculation of these quantities like scattering cross sections. That's what I mean. I don't mean that you do quantum field theory without ever thinking about this. I mean, that's of course usually not true. Usually you do start with this. But partially I'm arguing against this and saying, well, so the operational meaningful content is in those guys. So
you only want the S matrix, but just I mean, you can just do the path integral. You don't need any of these operator products.
I agree.
The time order product is just a translation.
Yes. Yes. So you're jumping ahead.
Observables like the energy of a mood, for example, they are not. They point to a mode, not to a specific point in space and time. So I don't understand really. Usually the observables refers to a mode, and the mode can be completely non-local.
Yes, so these would be observables that would be smeared all over all of space, for example. I mean, such ones, yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, the reason why I'm talking about these observables preferentially here is that I want to make a point, and then later we can come back to a more general case. So of course I agree that there are more general observables than those. But for the time being, just think about those and perhaps smear them in with test functions or something.
Which observables do you have in mind?
So the ones I'm talking about here are like phi of x and d/dt phi of x, right?
It is not always an observable. No. I mean, you mean the field operator. It's not an
observable.
I mean, it's not something you can get out of a measurement. Depends what you
mean. Yeah, well,
if your heuristic notion of observable is something you can measure, then it's not. This was my complaint. Then it's not an observable. The observables are the subsets of these sets.
Well, it is observable in the same sense that a position operator is observable.
Oh, no, because the function of the field at the position x.
Well, and also the issue of that you have to smear.
The position x is not an observable in quantum theory. So
no, of course not. I mean, phi of x doesn't ask for the position of some field, it asks for the value of the field at some point.
Right?
Okay,
so it's,
yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course, you can only get expectation values and transition.
It's maybe just a question of time, but you could have global, not be what people.
I mean, Bohr and Rosenfeld, for example, wrote this book in which they tried to show how you could measure field operators.
Yeah,
they tried to show how you could measure.
Yeah, I can show you how you can measure them if you want later.
Yeah, but an observable, so what people call an observable in the rational sense is.
Yes.
Right. It's not
just
it's more.
But it's some
field
operator.
Yeah, field operator, which is different from observers.
Maybe for my purposes, there are particular types of observers. Okay. Okay, after saying this about the non-commutative operator product, of course, if we think about the role that this operator product had in the non-relativistic setting, we can emulate that here with those labeled operators and recover it from the time order product, right? So this operator product would occur in the case where we have equal times, so that an equal time commutation relation really means that infinitesimally I apply first B and then A, and then I subtract the other order where I apply first A and then B. So I can simply take the usual labeled operators, and I just add a little epsilon to the time, or subtract a little epsilon, and I compare the different orderings, and then let epsilon go to zero, and I recover the equal time commutation relations from the time order product. Okay.
What is the capital T?
That stands for time ordering. Of course, here, since I wrote them explicitly in time order form, you could leave it out. So it's just forget it if you want. But just to emphasize the fact that this, in fact, are time order products. Okay, so now, I mean, usually, of course, you have commutation relations also at non-equal times, and then by generalizing this, and then for this to be consistent, one thing that you would have to have is that the commutator of two operators is zero if the space-time points are not causally related. right? I mean, this is the usual stuff that we find in textbooks, and that's that yeah, was referred to here before. So the main message here was, okay, when we have this time order product, that we can view the operator product in some sense as a derived concept. Okay. So another ingredient, locality. So this other problem I was talking about, that we don't want to talk about the whole universe, but we want to talk about the piece of it only, and in the manifest way. To, as a warm up to that, let's just think about classical field theory first. Just to introduce some aspects of what later is going to come in the quantum theory in this talk. Okay. So in a region M of space-time, the physics is then described by the space of solutions of the equation of motions in this region. Okay. And this is a, so if I state it like this, I'm not at all referring to or not knowing anything about what's happened outside this region. So the physics there could be completely different, or there could whatever could happen there. And then the observables for that region would just be the real valued functions on this space of solutions. And then if we have two regions of space-time, one inside the other one, then of course we get a solution in the larger region. Every solution in the larger region gives rise to one in the smaller region simply by restricting it there. So that means we get an observable here in the smaller region. In particular, it's also an observable in the larger region. Just doesn't care about how the field looks like outside the smaller region. Similarly, we can, if we have two adjacent regions, and a solution in this whole joint region, then of course it restricts the solutions in these partial regions. And similarly, an observable here and an observable here compose an observable in this whole region. Okay. So as I said, this is meant to, I mean, expose some structures which will occur in the quantum theory. Okay, so let's go for that now. So what I'm proposing, what one should do is one way to formulate a quantum theory, let's say, which I call the general boundary formulation. So the basic idea is very simple. So here this is expressed in terms of transition amplitudes. So in standard quantum mechanics, a transition amplitude tells you, so you have an initial state at time t1, a final state at time t2, and the transition amplitude somehow lets you calculate, for example, how probable it is that you will measure the state psi2 if you have prepared the state psi1 before. So this is to describe really the time evolution in your system. Now, if you're in perfect space-time, you could do the same with respect to some fixed foliation of space-time. So then these are space like hypersurfaces which carry the states. And you have transition amplitudes. Now, the generalization I want to push here is that one way to think of this is that you really have, in some sense, you're really describing the physics that's inside this region, inside this time interval, okay, by this transition amplitude. So if we take now an arbitrary region in space-time, which doesn't necessarily have this shape, and postulate that we have a Hilbert space of states associated with its boundary, and then we have amplitudes associated with the interior. Okay, so let's make this more concrete. So the basic space-time structures we're talking about are regions of space-time and oriented hypersurfaces, which, for example, can occur as boundaries of these regions. And the basic algebraic structures we associated with them are, for each hypersurface, we have a Hilbert space states. And for each region, we have a linear amplitude map from this Hilbert space to the complex numbers. Okay. So for those of you familiar with topological quantum field theory, the formalism that is used to set all this up, and especially the axioms that these structures are subject to, are in some sense a special version of topological quantum field theory, but with infinite dimensional vector spaces. Okay, so of course now we have this vast number of regions of, I mean, if you have a given space time, of course you can take any region, and so you would have, for each one, you would have this amplitude map for each hypersurface, a Hilbert space. How do all these things fit together? Right. So, and this is what these axioms are for. So, for example, if I take a hypersurface and I change its orientation to the opposite, then the associated Hilbert space will be the dual of the original one. If I have a hypersurface that decomposes into disjoint pieces, then the Hilbert space associated with the hypersurface is simply the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for all the pieces. Okay. And then something very important is a viewing rule. So if we have two adjacent regions that we can glue together, then this amplitude function associated with this whole region is a certain composition of the amplitudes map associated with the first and with the second region here. So I didn't write down the formula explicitly because then I would have to explain more details. Yeah?
Can you go to the previous slide?
Oh, yeah, yes.
Oh,
the
even previous
right.
So are you free, because so you're saying that on the boundary, on the blue boundary, you just put anything you want, right?
Well, a state space. It's not anything
so,
I want.
So you don't put this, you put the state of the system at every point in the space-time
boundary.
No,
no, it's the states sit on this boundary,
yes.
on the whole boundary.
On the whole boundary?
Yes.
Yeah, so at every point, you give the state of the system.
No. I mean, like here, I mean, if you think of this picture first.
Yeah.
So here, if you have a state, it's really something that describes the system in all of space at a given time.
Yes.
Right. So in the same way here, so in some sense, a state here describes the system and on this whole boundary here.
Absolutely.
At this time. Uh-huh. Okay.
So. But I don't understand how you can do it freely, because now imagine that that region has a particular best shape.
Right.
Now you are not free to choose what you want, right? Because you are constrained by the dynamics. So.
Yeah. Okay. I see where you're getting. So if you write down a transition amplitude, then of course you're free to put what you want. But this freedom is not if you do that, this involves already asking a question of your system in some sense. For, I mean, if you want, for example, you calculate the probability that is the modulus squared of some transition amplitude, right? Then you're putting a state here and another state here freely. But of course, this freedom is not the freedom that the dynamics allows you. It's a freedom that you have to say what you prepared and what you're observing. Okay? So in this very same sense, you have freedom here. But in the same sense, I'll come back later to that, and I hope it will get clearer. So, yeah, so that, in fact, that's very important, that the state here doesn't have the same status as the state here. The state here should really be thought of as something that corresponds to a tensor product of a state here and a state here.
So can you explain to me what happens if, as a shape, there I choose in particular the first shape?
Yeah, that will be my next transparency.
Oh, okay.
So perhaps we should turn. Okay. So I was explaining these rules. So the third is this the screwing rule, which tells me that from an amplitude here and here, I get an amplitude in this whole region, and this involves in somehow a sum over complete bases on this shared boundary here. So it's similar to in ordinary quantum mechanics inserting a complete basis when you want to compose two transition amplitudes, for example. But now I will come to your point. So this is the picture, okay, that you had in mind. Okay, so this is in particular the standard type of region. So now the question is, how are the standard structures recovered from these more general structures that I was talking about? So here the region is just time interval, time sort of space, and its boundary has two components, right? At time t1 and at time t2. Now, remember the rule from the previous page, this one here, that tells you that this means that this total Hilbert space is a tensor product of Hilbert spaces, one associated to the initial time and one associated to the final time. Okay, and then what we do, usually that you just think about one Hilbert space for your system and not many Hilbert spaces. So here a priori we have many, but now we see that we in fact have one for each, in particular we have one for each time, and now we suppose that we can identify those Hilbert spaces with a given Hilbert space. Okay, so in the sense they're all the same, we use tram translation symmetry to relate them all to the same Hilbert space. So this is what in ordinary quantum mechanics you do without thinking about it. Okay, you say the Hilbert space, if I think about a state at a given time and then let it evolve, I want to think of it as being in the same Hilbert space, right? So we can do the same here in this special geometry. Okay, so nothing surprising about this really. And then what is the structure we have associated with this region? It's this amplitude map. So it's a map from the total Hilbert space to C. Okay, but this total Hilbert space, in fact, turns out now to be H tensor H star, where H is this one Hilbert space that we associate everything. So this the star here comes from the fact that these two hypersurfaces have opposite orientation, and there was this rule that told us that when the orientation is reversed, then there's a dualization happening. Okay, so this is why there's one H and one H star here. Okay. But this is, of course, exactly what we need in some sense. If you think of these as cat vectors and these as bra vectors. Right? So the relation between this rho and the usual transition amplitude is then precisely this. So rho for a state psi tensor state eta is simply the transition amplitude where you put psi here initially and eta at the final time, and here this is just the usual time evolution of the region. Okay. So this really is the connection between the two things.
I don't quite understand, it's related to the earlier question. You can't specify the state, the initial state, while staying arbitrarily. You can't just say, give it a fixed dynamics. But the initial state plus the dynamics determines the final state.
I'm doing it here in the same sense as I do it here. Okay. Well, so this rho, I mean the question is just what does this rho mean? What's its physical meaning? Okay. And this rho is really something that generalizes transition amplitudes. So you can specify what you want, but of course it could be contradicted by the dynamics. So that could mean, for example, if you choose a state that's orthogonal to the state that you are evolving into, then this will just be zero, which means this thing will just be zero. Okay, so it's more like something that tells you if what you put in is physically correct or not. It's more like that.
It's just the propagator, right? It's just what people call the propagator.
Right, yeah. Or transition amplitude.
Okay, yeah, transition propagator is just another word.
Yeah, if you want to call it propagator. I choose to call something else which is related but not the same, propagator. But, well, it's a question of terminology.
No, I'm not asking to change the terminology. I was just thinking that other word might pair up some people what the concept is.
Okay, so then there's a... let's go back to that. So here, of course, if we have a transition amplitude of this type, we know how we can extract probability from this and thus make a statement about actual experiments that we can compare this to. So the question is how can we do such a thing in this more general case where you have some arbitrary region? Okay, this is generalized probability interpretation. I'll go a bit faster now because I want to tell you some more things. So one thing which we're using all the time is, of course, that probabilities in quantum theory are really conditional probabilities. So they somehow take two ingredients, right? Two pieces of information, which is usually the preparation and the observation. So the initial state, if you want, and the final state in the usual setting. Now here I'm allowing to this preparation, or we can also call it knowledge about the system, to be a subspace of this Hilbert space that's associated with the boundary. And the observation or the question we are asking is another subspace. Okay. And then the probability that the system is described by A, given that it is described by S, is given by this formula here. Okay. So maybe I should explain that. Later I will go back to the standard setting and show how the standard formula is the special case of this. But first let me try to explain just a little bit. So these are subspaces here. So PA and PS are the orthogonal projectors onto these subspaces, simply. This little circle here is simply the composition. So for example, here we take a vector, we apply the projector, and then we apply this amplitude map rho, which gives us a complex number. So the entity in between these lines here is a map from my Hilbert space to the complex numbers. Also here in the numerator. So this map actually has to be a bounded linear map. So it's in the dual Hilbert space, okay? And in this dual Hilbert space, I have I also have an inner product there, and I can say what is the modulus, or in this case, modulus square of this map, okay? So that makes sense here. Or you can also think of this as the induced norm of this as a function on a normed space. Yeah. But it's something completely standard.
Always minimum of H star, right?
There are some subtleties, but let's say yes, okay?
And P is also an element of H star, right?
No. It's an element of operators.
How do you take the modulus? So what does it mean to take
the modulus? So the composition, so rho is a map from H to C, okay?
Yes.
P is a map from H to H. So the total is a map from H to C again.
Yes.
S is rho. And so I take
the square
the norm of that, the square of the norm of this map. Well, another possibility is to write this explicitly with by inserting, by applying it to an orthonormal basis, then summing over this orthonormal basis. That's the same. But yeah, let's. Well, I think if there are more questions about this, I prefer to answer them later. Or just if there's a more conceptual question.
There is a conceptual. So are we to think of this as a prescription related ultimately to measurements? Or are we to think of this something that just has a meaning independent? So S and rho of S and A have to be represented by some physical operations.
Yes,
that
exactly.
An external observer.
Right, yeah, precisely. Yeah.
So I was about to ask the same question. So this has the same, I mean, you can raise the same criticism against this approach as the Copenhagen one, where you always would have an external observer. Mm-hmm. This thing would require the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. I completely agree. So here also, I'm supposing an external observer, so I'm not addressing at all this issue. But the important difference, in some sense, is that I'm talking manifestly about a fixed region of space-time. So there's no problem conceptually with the observer living outside of that region. Okay. Okay, so now back to the standard probability. So here's again the picture that represents the standard geometry. Let me say again, then this generalized amplitude is just the usual transition amplitude. So if we just want to compute a usual probability, namely the modulus square of this here, meaning that we prepare the state psi here, and we're looking for the state eta here, then this is simply encoded as follows. So S, the subspace that specifies what is prepared in the measurement, is just the subspace. Remember that the whole Hilbert space is a tensor product, so it's the subspace of those states that can be written as psi tensor something. Okay? All those states, this is the subspace. And then for the question we are asking here, the subspace is simply all states that can be written as something tensor eta. Okay, this tensor product. And then if you plug that in, you will find that this probability is precisely the usual one. Okay. Of course, this is a very special situation here. But okay, so let me move on. I think I won't go. There's also a concept of probability conservation, which is more general than the usual one. So you can talk about probability conservation in space-time, and not just in time now. But I don't want to go into that. I want to talk about observables now. So this is the more new stuff here. So in accordance with this locality principles, we want observers also to be associated to space-time regions. And the way we will encode them is simply using the same type of maps as these amplitude maps. Okay, so they are all an observer in the space-time region M is also now encoded as a map from the Hilbert space in the boundary to the convex numbers. So if you want, you can think of this as in the standard setting, if you take a transition amplitude and plug in an observer at some intermediate time, this kind of modified transition amplitude, what you get, would correspond precisely to this modified amplitude here. Okay. So just to have a more intuitive picture of what's this supposed to mean. So then we have certain operations we can do with this observer. So if we have an observable in some I think I made a little mistake here. This should be an N here, not an M. So suppose we have an observer in the smaller region here, then this gives rise to an observer in the larger region by taking this map rho Fn, this would be an N, and composing it with the row with the amplitude map that corresponds to n without n. Okay. And this, yeah, I haven't really explained you how this composition works, but this then gives a map from this boundary Hilbert space to C, which we then call rho f m union n. Okay. So the important thing is an observable, some region, gives rise to automatically to an observable in any larger region that contains this original region. Similarly, if we have two adjacent regions and we have an observable here and another observable here, we can also compose them to some new observable in the combined region. So maybe here you can remember these pictures here. I mean, why I drew these things here and talked about this stuff here. Okay.
So, picking a particular observable in N.
Shall I go back to the slide where I was?
Sure. Okay. It's just the.
Yeah. Okay.
So, an observable in N, does that give rise to a unique observable in M? In the next one up?
Yes. So an observable here gives rise to a unique observable in this region, right? Because of this rule, I mean, you're just you compose with the row that corresponds to no observable present in some sense that corresponds to just time evolution without.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it's supposed to work.
Sorry, I might have missed it. Did you tell us what F was? What kind of object?
No, F is a label here only. It's nothing, it's a label. And it's just maybe the notation is not so great.
But the question is, what does it range of? I mean, you have to somehow.
You mean of this row MF?
No.
What does it have? What are its properties?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I haven't. The problem is if I talk more about this, getting a bit more technical. I don't have a nice axiom yet that tells you exactly. I can tell you some things but maybe later that gives some indications what properties must have. But anyway, these are important points that I have these operations available here in this formalism. Now, of course, an important question is how do I get expectation values from these observables? So what's their physical interpretation? So again, this is a kind of conditional statement. I mean, usually we'd say, oh, what's the expectation value of the observer A in the state psi? So it's conditional on psi. So in the same way, since we condition things on subspaces, again, we do the same here. I see now that I, well, okay. No. So here so rho fm is representing this observable. It's this map that represents the observable. And here I've written an inner product. And this inner product is again in this dual space of maps. Of linear maps on my Hilbert space and not in the original space, but that's just a technicality. And here I have abbreviated rho m composed with a projector onto S by this notation, because in fact I can think of this composition as an observable, which is the observable that in some sense projects onto the subspace S.
So I don't understand the physical interpretation of this, because when the region is like the standard region, it's very clear what you mean by preparing and measuring.
Right.
Because you first prepare and then at the later time you measure and then you're immersed in time, right? And now what it means? Preparations and measurements, I mean, as long as you say preparations and measurements, something comes first. And something comes then, right? But now it's there is no time there anymore.
Right.
So I don't understand.
Yes. So So one thing to say about this is that already in the standard formalism, it's when you talk about conditional probabilities, it's not necessary that your preparation predates your measurement in some sense. You can talk about conditional, of course the word preparation maybe is not very adequate. But for example, you can consider the case,
the physical interpretation always goes through a real preparation, a real measurement.
Not necessarily. For example, you take a standard transition amplitude and the modulus square of this. So you can, for example, ask the question, you can put some person in a room and tell him, okay, prepare measurements randomly from this, let's say, finite subspace of my Hilbert space with equal probability, and you make measurements, and then you can use those measurements to work out what probability distribution this guy has used to prepare the measurements. So, So in this sense, this means that the question you're asking in the experiment refers to what happened at the earlier time. And the thing you know is what you measure, because what you do is you select only those measurements that all have the same outcome, or the same outcome in the same subspace. Okay, you just throw away the other ones. So in that sense, your measurement becomes, the part that usually corresponds to preparation in your conditional probability. That's something that you certainly know about your measurement. So of course it's much less intuitive to think about in this way of quantum experiments, and it's not very useful to think in this way, but it's possible to do that even in the standard formalism. So from that point of view, what I'm doing here is not so new. I mean, this aspect of what I'm doing is not, it's something that's a bit counterintuitive, but that already occurs in the standard formalism. If you really think about it. I mean, you really have to think about more carefully, how do I set up this experiment, and
I would like to see an example.
Yes, yes. Yeah, for example, in my, in the, paper that I wrote about this in 2005, there are several examples of this type, precisely true. Because it's really a bit counterintuitive at first, I agree. Okay, so I will conclude my talk with this slide. I don't know if I have time to show the other one too. Now, where are the commutators? So that's why I call this thing against commutators, because obviously so far we haven't used any, or we haven't used operator algebras in some manifest way. But you can get them back. Okay. And in fact, so this goes a bit towards now thinking of operator algebras as in the framework of algebraic quantum field theory. Okay, so given a metric background structure, we can recover the usual operator algebras and commutators. So for this, we consider a space-time region that this blue one here that contains a Cauchy hypersurface, for example, a causal diamond. Okay, and the reason why I'm choosing an example of this type is precisely because I want to get my answers in something that's similar to the framework of algebraic quantum field theory, where you talk about algebras of operators associated with such types of regions of space-time. Okay, so now we decompose this region into three pieces, namely the region that corresponds to all the events before C, the region that corresponds to all the events after C, and C itself. And we can think of C as, in a sense, as a region that is infinitely thin. So you can well, think of this as a limit where I deform C a little bit to the future and a little bit to the past, so that I really get a space-time region and taking the limit where this, where C itself is approached. So you just have to believe me that this makes sense in my formulas. Okay, that, but there's related to the technical issues that I really don't want to go into now. So if we have this decomposition, then we can correspondingly we can glue amplitude maps and observables in these three regions together. Right.
Did you the definition of what you mean by observable in this context?
It's precisely what I said here. So you can just say it's a map from here to here. That's all you need for the moment.
The only thing that exists is the whole F of M, but F
yes.
as such doesn't exist.
F is a label.
What type of label?
An index, if you want. I mean, you can give a different name to this whole thing, if you want. And it's the reason why I chose this peculiar notation is simply because I want to emphasize that as a mathematical object, it's very similar to rho m. That's why I wrote it rho mf.
So any but linear map from the boundary of that region to the complex numbers is a sum of circles.
Well, there are some technical conditions that, and but it, essentially, yeah, for the purposes of what I'm going to tell you, you can think in this way. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have this observable associated with this whole region. Okay. And now it turns out that in this precise situation, there's a unique observable associated with this hypersurface. As I said, you should think of this as an infinitely thin region, such that this is the composition of the evolution here, the amplitude map here without observable, this observable here, and the evolution here again without observable. Okay, and the reason that this is true uses well, I mean, to really explain you this in detail, I would have to tell you much more about this formalism and the axioms, how this works. But it has, physically, it has to do with the background metric that we have, which implies that classically, for example, if I have initial data here, they completely determine my classical field here, and vice versa. Which means that in the quantum theory, this amplitude map can be written as so its boundary can be decomposed into two components and can be written as a unitary operator from one boundary component to the other one. Okay. So this rho m1 and this rho m2 in some sense are similar to unitary operators. So I can invert them in particular. Okay, so what I want, I want to specify this, and I want to get this out. So really, I have to invert those things, but I can. And then I get this thing uniquely determined. Okay, but the important message here is that an observable here in this whole region gives rise to an observable in this infinitely thin region. And it furthermore is then the case that if I have these infinitely thin regions, then we can interpret this amplitude as an operator on the Hilbert space, which corresponds precisely to this boundary, okay, to this hypersurface C. So in a sense, the region, this infinitely thin region, is two copies of C glued together in some sense. And so this rho F C is a map from a tensor product of HC times HC star to C. And then if we dualize one component, we get a map from HC to itself, an operator. So this precisely is a recipe that would tell you how from an observable in the general boundary setting, you get a corresponding operator in an algebraic quantum field theory setting. And of course, then these operators form a usual non-commutative operator algebra. But it's important to emphasize the fact that we use a metric background structure. Of course, it's used in a very indirect way, because this is then responsible for the fact that these things can be inverted. Okay, but if there's no metric background, then physically there's no reason why these should be invertible, and this whole thing wouldn't work. Okay. And of course, algebraic quantum field theory needs a background metric, and otherwise it doesn't work.
So does this amount to show that, to prove that you really need the background structure to make sense of the commutator notion?
Well, I don't know if you want to say proof, but let me phrase it in a different way. Let me say I don't see any way to make sense of the commutator if I don't have a metric account. Yes, in this way I would say it.
Isn't the statement you don't have operators? You don't have the operator.
Yeah, in particular, I don't have operator algebra.
It's a special case you don't have a commutator.
Right. Yes. Yeah, of course.
You don't have an anti-commutator.
Right. Oh, yeah, indeed. Well, I'm already a bit over time. I have just one transparency left, so
I should
put it on. So this thing about the new correspondence principle, hence, so this is much more tentative than everything else you've seen. So suppose now that we want to make a correspondence between classical and quantum observables. Okay, so we have, for region M, we have classical observables. And we want to say, okay, to such a classical observable corresponds a quantum observable. And now I'm using essentially the same notation as before, except here this A is now not an index, but it means this is the image of this under this kind of correspondence map, which of course I haven't specified. Okay. Now suppose that I have two adjacent regions again, and a classical observable A here in this region, and a classical observable B in this region N. Now, I already told you that I can then form a joint, a composed quantum observable for this whole region. Of course, classically, I can also do that. I can look at the observable, which is the product of A and B in this larger region. And then I can ask for this equation to be satisfied, namely that the quantized observable in A composed with the quantized observable in B is the same as the classical composition of the observable quantized in the region M union N. Okay. So the strange thing about this is that, I mean, in quantum theory, we always say, okay, they're non-commutative operator algebras, and the classical observables are represented in a way that the classical algebra becomes deformed to a non-commutative algebra and so on. And here this looks completely different. It looks like we're just having the usual classical algebra also in the quantum theory, in some sense. And yes, we do if we demand this. However, in a restricted sense, because I cannot. So if I have an observable A here and B is also in the same region, I cannot compose them. I can only compose observables if they refer to disjoint or maybe or space-time regions or space-time regions that just touch. Okay, if they intersect, I cannot compose them. So it's weaker, but anyway, it's much more like a direct representation of the commutative algebra.
Usually, if n is in the future of m, or m is in the future of n, then you don't get the same composition. It's only if you have the space like a region here.
Here, all these observables are relative to the space-time regions in which they live. So what is first and what is later is completely fixed by this. So there's no choice. There are no different types of compositions that I can make. Of course, if you want go back to commutators, you can do precisely this. Okay. However, these commutators don't have the operational meaning that maybe you want to give to them, right? So the first thing to say, so this could be one ingredient of a correspondence principle that could be applied to this framework. And the other thing is, this is true in quantum theory. And precisely using the path integral you want. So in quantum field theory, you can compute such things with the observables that I talked. So when I say quantum field theory, again, I mean it in this restricted sense that I was talking about before. Here, right, in this sense. So as you pointed out, if I insert an observable into the path integral, which is precisely means that in my formalism, it would mean I compute this row with this observable in, then it has precisely this property that that I have this composition here. And of course, the time order product in quantum field theory is a kind of pre-step to this in this sense. I mean, here what comes, the extra ingredient is that you're really talking about a space-time region with boundaries, and you put an operator inside or observable inside, and then you compose them and so on.
There's still some kind of choice. Suppose I have two cylinders like that, and call them A and B. Then I can glue them like that or glue them like that.
And I will I can only glue them in one way.
Why? They're the same.
No, because if you take one and move it to the bottom, you transform it to a different region.
What do you mean by region? I take. If they are already like a big region of space time, yes. But if I have m and m twice this region, and then I have the state rho m, and then the state rho m of v, then there is no way to compose it.
Yeah, but this changes what the observable is. I mean, quantum field theory language, it changes your labels.
So it depends. Rho m of a is it defined? Independently of the embedding I'm going to put it in the product, or is it?
So if you talk about quantum field theory, then everything has a fixed place in space-time.
No, but it's in your
context. And so what you're talking about is really this here. And of course, if I glue things this way around or this way around, I get a different answer. This commutator is not zero in general.
But I can do that.
But that's because there's this epsilon here. I mean, this is really a limit. I mean, I'm talking about a setting where I don't take any limits, but this epsilon is finite.
But the epsilon is defined by the degree. Suppose I have a region M, and I have a state the whole M of A, and there's no epsilon on time, it's just a region there. And then I duplicate it, and I put the whole M of B. And because they are the same region as the cylinder, I can decide to create a new region like that. It should be of the same topology, either like that or like that. And there will be two different.
But that's not what you're doing here. I mean, No. I mean, here, the label is with respect to global space-time background. Okay, so in a global space-time background, if you take this type and put it to the bottom, you're changing the T label. And of course, so it's in that theory, it's a different observer.
Do you agree that given, let's say, A and B, I can compose them in two different ways?
Well, if you allow to really transform, I mean, if you, for example, you could allow to subject observables to space-time isometries. Okay. I mean, when we're talking about a fixed metric background, then we should really think of a fixed space-time, and we have regions in that space-time. Okay.
Well, maybe. I was just thinking that in your context, what you have is that you give me a whatever piece of space-time, boundary matrix fixed, and then I have to play with that. If I do that, suppose I
can not, not only the boundary, the metric is fixed everywhere.
Yeah, suppose the cylinder is fixed and the top metric and the bottom metric are the same. Therefore, I can just do them as I want.
Yeah, I mean, that corresponds precisely to taking the same A and B and just first remove the A here and the B here and then the other way around. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, but then, of course, you have changed the T label.
Maybe
with respect to your background space time. Yeah.
One thing I'm wondering, this is a general question. You say that going from ordinary special relativistic quantum field theory, well, you have two disconnected hypersurfaces. And then you say that the natural generalization of that is going to close hypersurfaces.
Yeah.
Why do you prefer that than, for example, just considering general non-intersecting hypersurfaces like that in any direction? But why isn't that the generalization?
That could be admissible. I have some examples that are of this type.
Okay. And then you can also consider any kind of hypersurfaces, right? Topologically disconnected ones, and for each choice of these things, you associate a quantum state, for example.
Yes. I mean, you would expect that there could be some. One thing I should clarify perhaps about. So this is a formalism that you can try to put different theories into. Okay, so you could say, okay, now, for example, I want to describe quantum field theory in Minkowski space. Okay, then these regions are regions in Minkowski space. Or you could say, I want to describe quantum gravity. Then I have no metric. And then these regions, in some sense, become something more abstract because there will be manifolds which don't carry a metric. Maybe they just have a differentiable structure. So there are different ways you could fill this formalism with, right, or different theories. But in quantum field theory, you would say, okay, so I have a fixed metric, and then these regions are sub-regions of Minkowski space, say. But you probably will not want to allow every crazy type of thing that you can imagine. Yes, so unfortunately I cannot give you a comprehensive characterization which regions exactly I want to allow in that case and which I don't, because I this is not completely worked out. But for example, the standard regions are admissible. What is admissible if you rotate them, and so for example you take two hyperplanes that are time-like and parallel, and so you can think of transition amplitudes between these hyperplanes, which are time-like, and that works perfectly fine. Another nice example is take a ball in space and extend it over all of time, so it's kind of hypercylinder in space-time, and that has the nice feature that it has a connected boundary, so you cannot go back to the situation where you say, okay, the boundary decomposes into two things, and I can think of as one is in and one is out. No, that doesn't work anymore. But so that's why this is a more interesting example for a region. But you can show that if you can perfectly well describe the physics of a scalar field, for example, in that context, including. So one thing I did recently was. Together with Daniele Colossi, like a year ago, 1.5 years ago, is to derive the S matrix from such a geometry. Okay, so usually the S matrix is obtained in a way that you think of transition from free particles at early time to free particles at late time, and you have interaction in the meantime, and then you send these initial and final times to infinity. So it turns out that you take this hypercylinder that I was talking about. So you have this space region, which is a ball, and you let the radius go to infinity, and you talk about free particles at infinity, and you this asymptotic amplitude that you will then get is you can show that this is isomorphic to the S matrix in a suitable sense, under a suitable mapping between the boundary Hilbert spaces. So,
yeah. We should probably round up. So thank you very much.
Thanks.